you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Something I think I've mentioned on the show before is that I think about etiquette a lot, because in my lifetime, there's been just a huge shift in how we interact with other people. Like, social media did not exist when I was born, and now it is a major way that a lot of people communicate with one another. And I don't know if anyone has heard, feels like etiquette hasn't really kept up with that shift a lot of the time. There is a lot of stuff on social media happening continually that I would say is inconsiderate, like, at best. A lot of it actively, incredibly rude. A lot of people use the word manners and etiquette interchangeably, but they have slightly different but interrelated meanings. Different sources, of course, give slightly different definitions, but essentially, manners, that's a person's conduct or behavior. And then etiquette is the code of manners or the rules that delineate what good manners are. Books on etiquette, which is what we are talking about today in this installment of Six Impossible Episodes, they don't necessarily reflect the rules that everyone is actually following. So if you're reading a historical etiquette manual, it's not necessarily depicting what day-to-day life is like for people. It's more like what the author thinks the ideal standard of behavior should be. So today, we're going to do a little Six Impossible Episodes on a selection of etiquette manuals from history. And to be very clear up front, this is focused on manuals that were either written in or translated into English, because that's the language I am fluent in. And it also felt way outside of my lane to be commenting on etiquette books from parts of the world that I have no cultural connections to or experience with, where, you know, the rules of etiquette might seem strange to me.
You must give your neighbor a duck. The first work that we are going to discuss came out in 1558, and its author was Giovanni della Casa of Florence, who was born on June 28, 1503, to a well-off and aristocratic family. He seems to have been a little bit of a troublemaker in his youth, including writing some satiric and suggestive verse, but eventually he moved into writing lyric poetry and translating other works, and in 1544 he was named Archbishop of Benevento. Unlike most of the existing manuals of behavior and conduct that were written before this point, this one wasn't focused on courtly behavior and diplomatic protocols. It was about how to behave yourself out in the world. Giovanni finished it in 1555, and he died on November 14, 1556. Although he had instructed his family to burn all of his documents, they published this book as Il Galateo Overo de Costumi, or Etiquette, or rather Customs, 2 years later.
This treatise was quickly translated into multiple other languages. It became really influential in a lot of Europe. It made its way into English for the first time in 1576 after being translated by Robert Peterson. And then it was retranslated and republished in English at different points after that, including in London in 1774 as Galateo, or A Treatise on Politeness and Delicacy of Manners Addressed to a Young Nobleman. That is the one that we are focused on today. Books on etiquette have often been written in response to changing social norms or a perceived need to address some kind of big shift in people's behavior, whether such a shift was actually happening or the kinds of people who write etiquette books just thought that was what was happening. This retranslation came out as the Industrial Revolution and other social and economic changes were making it more possible for people to climb the social and economic ladder. So there was this idea that newly affluent people might not know how to act.
The preface to this 1774 English edition made it clear that Italy was seen as the birthplace of good manners. It, quote, shows to what a degree of refinement, both in manners and in literature, the Italians were arrived at a period when we were just emerging from Gothicism and barbarity. It also makes clear that, in the translator's opinion, English society has progressed since the work was first written, to the point that some of the examples might seem absurd. But at the same time, he mentions some very gross behavior that he's seen from other people, including a man spitting so vociferously it startled other people, and a woman using her napkin to clean her teeth after dinner. And those were points of evidence that a book like Galateo was still needed.
So we can really sum up this book's whole approach to etiquette with this quote, quote, "It is to be observed, then, that whatever is offensive or disagreeable to any one of our senses, or contrary to our natural instincts and desires, and further, whatever raises in our minds an idea of anything filthy or indecent, or what shocks our understanding, I say that everything and every action of this kind, being as greatly displeasing to others, is carefully to be avoided. Nothing, therefore, either filthy or immodest, nauseous or disgusting, ought not only to be done, but even mentioned in the presence of others."
Some examples of things to be avoided: finding something stinky and saying to the person next to you, "Smell this, it smells terrible." Similarly, grinding your teeth, just breathing too loud. I feel like I do that one. Making horrible noises when coughing or sneezing. Howling like a wolf while yawning, which I think we should all adopt, actually. Expectorating in company. Smelling glasses of wine or plates of food belonging to other people. Speaking about vulgar subjects. Being profane about God, whether you are serious or joking. Going on at length about what you dreamed about last night. Lying, arrogance, buffoonery, and giving unsolicited advice, especially to people who are not your true and intimate friends.
I like how many of these are still things that people point out. Also, Giovanni della Casa sure did not like jingling puns, as well as what we might describe today as dad jokes. Quote, "You will meet also with some people who, for every word that is spoken, have some other word, without any meaning, ready at hand by way of jingle. Others who will change the syllables in a word in a trifling, foolish manner. Others will speak and answer in a different manner from what we expected, and that without any wit or beauty of thought, as, 'Where is thy lord?' 'In his clothes, unless he is bathing or in bed.' 'How does this wine taste?' 'A little moist, I think.' 'How is this dish to be eaten?' 'With your mouth.' And the like. All which kinds of wit, as you will easily apprehend, are low and vulgar."
Giovanni, I'm with you. we can talk about that on Behind the Scenes. I'm not a pun fan. Next up, Letters to His Son on the Art of Becoming a Man of the World and a Gentleman by Philip Stanhope, 4th Earl of Chesterfield, purported namesake of the Chesterfield sofa. Philip had no children with his wife, but he did have two sons, and he wrote a series of letters to one of them, also named Philip, starting in 1737. The younger Philip died in 1768, and a few years later, his widow started publishing the letters because she really didn't have any other source of income. There was also a book that collected the parts that were focused on etiquette and combined it with other works, which was published as Principles of Politeness and of Knowing the World, and that came out in 1786.
I chose this as one of the things to talk about in today's episode because it is frequently cited as the first use of the word etiquette to mean something like rules for polite behavior in English. Turns out that doesn't really hold up, though. The word etiquette comes from a French word meaning label or ticket. And then later, this word etiquette was used to describe cards or signs that outlined rules for proper conduct at court. So that label was sort of a label on the wall telling you how to act. And then the word etiquette came to describe those rules themselves. The Earl of Chesterfield did use the word etiquette in these letters, starting with one that he wrote in 1750. But he was talking about those formal protocols, not a more general standard of good behavior. Specifically, in that letter, he was telling the younger Philip to follow the current protocols when he met the Pope. Nowadays, the Oxford English Dictionary also cites an even earlier use of this sense of the word etiquette from London Magazine in 1737.
Although the Earl did not write these letters with the intent of their ever being published, it makes a lot of sense that they came to be used as an etiquette manual once they were. Here's an example from October 16, 1747. Quote, "Dear boy, the art of pleasing is a very necessary one to possess, but a very difficult one to acquire. It can hardly be reduced to rules, and your own good sense and observation will teach you more of it than I can. Do as you would be done by is the surest method that I know of pleasing. Observe carefully what pleases you in others, and probably the same thing in you will please others. If you are pleased with the complaisance and attention of others to your humors, your tastes, or your weaknesses, depend upon it the same complaisance and attention on your part to theirs will equally please them. Take the tone of the company that you are in, and do not pretend to give it. Be serious, gay, or even trifling as you find the present humor of the company. This is an attention due from every individual to the majority."
There are hundreds and hundreds of pages of these letters. I mean, this is this man's correspondence to his son going on for many years. And as was the case with the Galateo, this was written to a man. It's focused on how a man should act. We are going to get through some other works and some works by women that were on etiquette after we have a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
A ton of etiquette manuals came out in the United States and Europe in the 19th century, thanks in part to developments in printing for a mass market. And of course, there were huge ongoing social changes related to things like race, gender, and class. All this happened before, during, and after the U.S. Civil War. Our next book was written in 1868, and it was published under the pseudonym Daisy Eyebright. That was really Sophia Orne Edwards Johnson. She was born in Springfield, Massachusetts, and then later moved to Bath, New Hampshire. We don't have a ton of detail about her life, but she was married to James H. Johnson, who was a colonel in the New Hampshire militia and also served two terms in the House of Representatives. He was more than 20 years older than she was, and she was his second wife, and they had three children together.
Like the younger Philip Stanhope's widow, Johnson turned to etiquette to try to earn some money, especially after her husband's lumber mill was destroyed in a flood in 1869. In addition to her book, A Manual of Etiquette with Hints on Politeness and Good Breeding, she also wrote books on homemaking and gardening, including Every Woman Her Own Flower Gardener in 1871 and Household Hints and Recipes in 1877. And she published columns on etiquette and household tips in newspapers.
Here is how she kicked off the preface to this book. Quote, "Men often speak of good manners as an accomplishment. I speak of them as a duty. What, then, are good manners? Such manners as the usages of society have recognized as being agreeable to men. Such manners as may take away rudeness and remit to the brute creation of all coarseness. There are a great many who feel that good manners are effeminate. They have a feeling that rude bluntness is a great deal more manly than good manners. It is a great deal more beastly. But when men are crowded in communities, the art of living together is no small art. How to diminish friction, how to promote ease of intercourse, how to make every part of a man's life contribute to the welfare and satisfaction of those around him, how to keep down offensive pride, how to banish the rasping of selfishness from the intercourse of men, how to move among men inspired by various and conflictive motives and yet not have collisions— this is the function of good manners."
Eyebright's opinions on etiquette and manners continued, quote, "Etiquette has been defined as a code of laws which binds society together, viewless as the wind, and yet exercising a vast influence upon the well-being of mankind." But she writes at the same time, quote, "Good manners are not merely conventional rules, but are founded upon reason and good sense, and are, therefore, most worthy of the consideration of all. And there are many points of good breeding which neither time nor place will ever change, because they are founded upon a just regard of man for man."
Like a lot of 19th century writers in the U.S., Daisy Eyebright framed etiquette and religion, specifically Christianity, as intrinsically connected. In her view, bad manners were not just rude, they were sinful. She describes the first code of good manners as the Epistle of St. James. And she also describes Philip Stanhope, Earl of Chesterfield, as the pattern of good breeding. And she includes a couple of quotes from his letters in her book.
Some of her rules for etiquette are more like marriage advice. Quote, "Nothing can be more injurious or inconsistent with true politeness and good breeding than the constant habit of fault-finding concerning little petty trifles, when indulged in by either husband or wife, in the presence of others, or by themselves."
This book also has a special section of advice to children, including, quote, be polite, respectful, and modest to all, and especially to your elders and superiors. There is nothing more disgusting than a youth who assumes an air of disrespect and self-importance toward his superiors, equals, or inferiors. This section aimed at children also included, quote, never go up and down stairs or about the house with the speed of a trotting horse and the tread of an elephant. Step lightly, quickly, and orderly.
There is a whole chapter in this book on visits of ceremony, visits of condolence, congratulation, and friendship, each of which has its own code of etiquette. A visit of friendship wouldn't be going over to a friend's for a dinner party. It's the formal visit to be made afterward as a gesture of thanks for having been invited. She talks about rules for what should be on your calling card, and that if you can't go for a formal visit, you should leave a card yourself or send it with a servant because, quote, it is not well-bred to send it through the post.
She describes these calling cards not just as a way of presenting yourself to the person being visited, but also as part of letting people know that you're going to be out of town. Quote, if previous to a long voyage or absence, or on the occasion of your marriage, you omit to call or send a card to your friends, it is understood that the acquaintance ceases. When you return home, those to whom you have sent cards or paid visits will pay the visit first to you.
This book has chapters on etiquette at home, receiving visitors, visiting others, table etiquette, dinner parties, evening entertainments, forms of address, social intercourse, dress, and marriage. Toward the end, there's a chapter with advice specific to husbands, wives, old bachelors, and old maids, and a final brief poem called Good Advice to Everybody, which reads, quote, if wisdom's ways you wisely seek, five things observe with care. Of whom you speak, to whom you speak, and how and when and where. Quaint.
It's very. Although it was written after the end of the U.S. Civil War, during the period of Reconstruction, Daisy Eyebright's A Manual of Etiquette with Hints on Politeness and Good Breeding makes almost no mention of race. Although it's presented as though its rules of etiquette apply to everyone, there's kind of an implicit assumption that the person reading it is white. The only specific mentions of anybody else are references to people doing things differently from what she considers typical of Americans, with Americans here meaning white, middle, and upper-class Christian Americans. It's clear that she just sort of sees this as the default. This is one of the ways that etiquette can be really fraught. There is often this underlying assumption that there's one right way of doing things that applies to everybody, without really acknowledging all the nuances that exist among people of different cultures and races and genders and classes and et cetera. This means that rules for etiquette can really easily be used to marginalize people outside of a society's dominant cultural group and have been used and are still used actively to marginalize people.
The next book that we're talking about is The National Capital Code of Etiquette, which was published in 1920, and it's almost the opposite. It's aware of race from the beginning. Its author, Edward S. Green, was a government employee living in Washington, D.C. In 1920, about 25% of the capital city's residents were Black. Green's publisher, Austin Jenkins Company, produced, quote, Bibles and special books for the colored race by Negro authors. The publisher's note at the beginning ends with, quote, we consider it a great pleasure and our especial privilege to respectfully dedicate this volume to the colored race.
The author's preface also starts with an anecdote about George Washington. In this anecdote, he bows and raises his hat to two Black laborers after they had done the same to him. And then when a friend that he was with said that it was undignified for him to have returned these laborers' salute, George Washington answered, quote, do you suppose I ever want to think that he had better manners than I did? Various elements of this story are very cringy to me. And then the preface went on to say, quote, thus spoke the perfect gentleman, kindly consideration of our inferiors as well as deference to our superiors is one of the first rudiments of good manners.
But this book is not about how Black people should interact with white society. Its audience is Washington, D.C.'s Black middle class and the rules for behavior within that society. And a lot of the actual rules parallel the ones in the books that we've already discussed. Like, quote, first, you know what displeases or angers you personally. Avoid all such words or actions in your contact with others. After a little bit about not monopolizing conversations, this part of the book continues, quote, third, strive to please. Study your friends and acquaintances. If they have hobbies, encourage them to talk about their specialty. This all sounds very familiar.
Yeah, a lot like the things that we've just talked about. Even though the rules themselves are often similar, though, the racial context of this book adds some additional nuances. Public schools and recreation facilities in Washington, D.C. were segregated, and after being inaugurated as president in 1913, Woodrow Wilson had empowered his administration to segregate the federal workforce. Black workers in Washington, D.C. were increasingly forced into lower-wage jobs and barred from opportunities that were open to their white coworkers. So while this book doesn't explicitly mention race after the preface, it's really threaded through with layers of things like respectability politics and a sense of racial uplift.
Here's what Edward S. Greene says about dressing for the types of formal visits that Daisy Eyebright also covered in her book. Quote, in making formal calls, the lady does not remove her gloves, hat, or veil. A gentleman may carry his hat into the room. If wearing gloves, the right should be removed and held in the left gloved hand during the call.
And here are his thoughts on dancing. Quote, the author has seen these spasmodic revolutions of the dancing public come and go for many years, but the custom invariably returns to the dreamy waltz, the more conservative dances, and the sane orchestra sooner or later. Unless at least seven musicians are employed, a drum is not only superfluous, it is an abomination.
Since this book was published in 1920, it was able to include photographs, unlike the earlier books that we've talked about. There are pictures of the social settings that were being described, examples of well-dressed people and the like. One thing that stands out is that most of the people in these pictures have relatively light skin. While the idea of racial uplift was theoretically focused on lifting up Black people as a whole, in reality, there was a lot of colorism, with people with lighter skin being seen as the best examples of the race.
This book also includes a lengthy section on writing letters, and it includes examples of letters for all kinds of different purposes. Like, there is a sample letter for a man who wants to propose to a woman in writing because he's either too timid to do it in spoken words or just feels better able to express himself in writing. Then there are examples of how she could write back to him, either accepting his proposal or turning it down. Then there's another example of his letter to her father asking for his permission to get married, followed by examples of letters from the father answering yes or no.
There are some sample letters in some of the other books that we're talking about today, but there are quite a lot of them in this one. And that makes a lot of sense, considering that this book was written a couple of generations after the abolition of slavery in the United States. Literacy rates in Black communities were still recovering from laws that had prohibited enslaved people and sometimes free Black people from learning to read and write.
Yeah, literacy rates had improved a lot within Black communities, but there were still big disparities between Black communities and white communities. And then within the Black community, there were disparities by age groups, with much younger people generally more often able to read and older people maybe not. After we take a quick sponsor break, we are going to talk about one of the more famous American etiquette books. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
When I started thinking about this episode, which I usually say at the beginning, we usually pick six things, or I usually pick six things that for whatever reason can't stand on their own. This one really probably could, the thing that we're going to talk about next, but I'm including it for reasons that I'm about to say. My original intent was that we would talk about some etiquette books that were fairly evenly distributed from the 16th century, when the focus of these books started to shift from like courtly protocols to more general rules of good behavior, up to sometime in the early 20th century when we get to the end of things being in the public domain so we can quote from them however much we want. I wound up, though, with more stuff from the early 20th century than I really had originally intended to. And one reason was that it seemed like it would just be weird to not touch on any of the more famous names in etiquette, like Emily Post.
Emily Post was a real person, born Emily Price in Baltimore, Maryland, in October of 1872. She was from a very well-off family. She went to private schools, she had a formal society debut. And she started writing after she and her husband divorced, once her children were in school. In addition to her works on etiquette, she wrote about things like architecture and interior design. Her father was a well-known architect. She also wrote novels and stories, many of which were published serially in magazines.
Her 1922 book, Etiquette in Society, in Business, in Politics, and at Home, is what she became most famous for. There have been lots and lots of subsequent editions of this book, revised and updated according to the changing social norms, including a centennial edition that came out in 2022. She eventually founded the Emily Post Institute, which is still a family business that is still run by her descendants and their spouses to kind of carry on her work in the field of etiquette.
That original 1922 work is in the public domain now, and a lot of the basic standards of etiquette it contains are, again, right in line with the earlier works we've been talking about. There are chapters on greetings, public gatherings, conversation, cards and visits, dinners, dances, weddings, and manners at home and abroad. There are also examples of letters and which styles of envelope are in good and bad taste.
The diagrams of envelope shapes that are in poor taste kind of cracked me up. This book became an enormous bestseller. It went through almost 90 printings and 10 revisions before she died in 1960. It's also seemingly exhaustive, clocking in at 38 chapters and 627 pages, including an index. That is about three times long or even longer than all the other books that we've talked about so far, with the exception of the Earl of Chesterfield's Letters, which Like, that was years and years of personal correspondence that he had never intended to have published as a book. As a side note, Lord Chesterfield is again name-dropped several times in this book.
This book is also very specific. Like, here's what to say when introduced. Quote, "Best society has only one phrase in acknowledgement of an introduction. How do you do? It literally accepts no other. When Mr. Batchelor says, 'Mrs. Worldly, may I present Mr. Struthers?' Mrs. Worldly says, 'How do you do?' Struthers bows and says nothing. To sweetly echo 'Mr. Struthers' with a rising inflection on 'theirs' is not good form. Saccharine chirping should be classed with crooked little fingers, high handshaking, and other affectations. All affectations are bad form. Persons of position do not say 'charmed' or 'pleased to meet you,' etc., but often the first remark is the beginning of a conversation. For instance, young Struthers is presented to Mrs. Worldly. She smiles and perhaps says, 'I hear that you are going to be in New York all winter.' Struthers answers, 'Yes, I am at the Columbia Law School,' etc. Or, since he is much younger than she, he might answer, 'Yes, Mrs. Worldly,' especially if his answer would otherwise be a curt yes or no. Otherwise, he does not continue repeating her name."
The idea of best society, which Holly said at the very beginning of that quote, that was at the heart of this whole book. Quote, "Society is an ambiguous term. It may mean much or nothing. Every human being, unless dwelling alone in a cave, is a member of society of one sort or another. And therefore, it is well to define what it is to be understood by the term best society and why its authority is recognized. Best society abroad is always the oldest aristocracy, composed not so much of persons of title, which may be new, as of those families and communities which have for the longest period of time known the highest cultivation. Our own best society is represented by social groups which have had, since this is America, widest rather than longest association with old world cultivation. Cultivation is always the basic attribute of best society, much as we hear in this country of an aristocracy of wealth."
In addition to spelling out that, in her mind, the best society in the U.S. is the people who have the widest association with old world cultivation, this book is underpinned by the idea that its readers have money. On the one hand, it frames good manners as something that everyone can aspire to. On the other, there are so many references to maids and servants and secretaries and housekeepers and butlers. One theory on why this book became so popular is that it gave everyone else a glimpse into the inner workings and manners of high society, full of fictionalized depictions of good breeding with names like Mrs. Kindheart and Mr. Worldly.
Yeah, I kind of cracked up at how often it was like, "And you can just send your secretary to do this." It's like, my what?
So easy.
Personally, I found Emily Post's 1922 etiquette to be way more overwhelming than any of the earlier books we have talked about. The basic idea of etiquette is pretty similar across all the books. Like, it's a way to try to make society better, try to make other people comfortable, and don't act like a jerk. It was not until I got to Emily Post's work that I started to feel worried about messing up all kinds of very particular little rules. Like, that whole passage that Holly read about greeting people really stressed me out. This book also felt judgier to me than a lot of the other works we have talked about today. As one example, there is a section on pronunciation, inherently a stressful subject to me, and it starts, quote, "A gentleman of Irish blood may have a brogue as rich as plum cake, or another's accent be soft Southern or flat New England or rolling Western, and to each of these the utterance of the others may sound too flat, too soft, too harsh, too refined, or drawled, or clipped short, but not uncultivated." This sounds almost like it's acknowledging that all these different accents can have a place in her best society. But then the next paragraph names the, quote, "cultivated Englishman" as nearest to perfection in English before describing the accents of New York, Boston, the South, and Pennsylvania in a way that came off to me as very insulting.
I can't wait to talk about Emily Post on Friday.
Oh, good.
Our last etiquette book for today is Emily Post's biggest competitor in the 1920s, Lillian Eichler, later Lillian Eichler Watson. We've been going chronologically up to now, but the copyright on her two-volume etiquette is from 1921, so that's a year before Emily Post's book.
I really wanted to do a full episode on Lillian Eichler a while back, but I just could not find enough information to make it work, which is one of the reasons why sometimes I do six impossible episodes. Lillian Eichler was the daughter of Jewish immigrants from Hungary, and she liked to write. At the age of 18, she got a job at an advertising agency on the strength of that writing. She really did not have much formal education or any experience beyond that. She basically showed them a sample, and then they hired her.
The advertising agency was Ruth Ralph and Ryan, and one of its clients was Doubleday Publishing. Lillian was tasked with writing an ad to help Doubleday sell through a backlog of an etiquette manual by Emily Holt. She wrote an ad about spilling coffee on a tablecloth and not knowing what to do, sort of like, has this ever happened to you? You can protect yourself from this kind of mortification with this book on etiquette. And this ad worked really, really well, and people bought the book, but a lot of them returned it because it was a reprint of an older book, and at this point, its advice was really out of date.
So then, Eichler wrote a new two-volume book of etiquette. Volume one of this book included etiquette for engagements, weddings, funerals, and christenings, letters, correspondence, and calling cards, and etiquette for parents and children. And then volume two included servants, dinners, luncheons, teas, dancing, games, and etiquette for things like business, theater, hotels, and travel. And also, like pretty much everyone in this episode, it references the work of Lord Chesterfield.
Eichler wrote the advertising campaign for these books as well. The most famous ad in this campaign ran under the headline, "Again She Orders, A Chicken Salad, Please," which told a story of a young woman who wanted to impress a man on a date, but didn't know how to pronounce the French words on the restaurant menu or how to converse with him. So she just kept ordering chicken salad, and all that folded in on itself to make her feel graceless and awkward. Another full-page ad that Eichler wrote for this book had the headline, "Are you haunted by the ghosts of your social mistakes?" Both ads noted that etiquette is the armor to protect yourself from such embarrassments.
I find "Are you haunted by the ghosts of your social mistakes?" just profoundly effective. Because yes, Lillian, I am. I am haunted by them all the time. As we said earlier, Lillian Eichler was Emily Post's biggest competitor in the 1920s. Eichler's Book of Etiquette sold 2 million copies, and it was revised and reprinted. Her tone was generally a lot more casual and conversational than Emily Post's. Eichler started it off, quote, "Success without culture is like old-fashioned strawberry shortcake without the whipped cream. It has no flavor. There are certain little courteous observances, certain social formalities that bespeak the true lady, the true gentleman. Some of us call it good form. Some of us call it culture. Some of us call it etiquette. But we all admit that it makes the world a better place to live in."
A bit later in the introduction, she wrote, quote, "Too rigid an observance of the laws of good society makes them nothing short of an absurdity. The purpose of correct manners is not to enable us to strut about in society and command the admiring glances of the people around us. As the peacock, in its vanity, parades before onlookers in a proud dignity that is quite obviously assumed. The true service of etiquette is so to strengthen and simplify the social life that we are able to do what is absolutely correct and right without even stopping to think about it."
Like any book from 100 years ago and all the other books we've been talking about today, parts of this are pretty backward by today's standards. Like, she acknowledges that a lot more women were making their way into the world of business, and that was something that she praised. But here is some of what she had to say about women in the workplace. Quote, "It took many centuries of hammering before the portals of business and industry and art were thrown wide open to women. Now that it has happened, it is her duty and pride to conduct herself in such a way that there can be no regrets and vain longings for the return of the woman of yesterday. By her manner and her dress, a woman determines her place, and the women who are careless of their appearance and careless of their standard are the ones who are hindering the progress of women toward the goal of perfect womanhood." When she enters business, she must realize that she is on an equal footing with men, and she should not demand or expect privileges simply because she is a woman. What she does and says and wears during the hours of her social life is entirely distinct from her business life, though. Of course, she is always courteous, however hard it may be sometimes to control herself under the grinding of the routine work at the office.
Her advice on tipping could have been written today, although her assertion is that it was a European custom and not an American one, and that's missing some big nuance. While tipping was introduced to the U.S. from Europe, it became widespread in the United States after the Civil War, when employers hired free Black people for low wages and then encouraged patrons to tip them for good service. In her advice, Eichler wrote, quote, "While the custom is observed as widely in this country as it is today, it is both inconsiderate and bad form to ignore it. The wages of waiters and waitresses, porters and hotel servants are outrageously small, for the reason that they receive tips for each service they perform for individual guests and travelers. If the tipping custom were abolished, the wages of these people would be correspondingly increased. But as things are now, it is inconsiderate to deprive them of the tips that both they and their employers expect that they will receive." On the other hand, though, she describes lavish tipping as vulgar. I don't agree with her there.
I don't either.
Mind your own business, Lillian.
Yeah. Lillian Eichler Watson continued to write about etiquette and other topics almost up until her death on June 25th, 1979. She had married Tobias F. Watson in 1928. They'd had two children together. But she had not turned her work into something of an etiquette empire that kept her name going and her recognition going after her death the way Emily Post did. I have lots of feelings about etiquette, and I think Holly has responded to a number of things in this episode, too. So we'll be talking about all that more on Friday.
Do you have listener mail for us?
I also have some listener mail for us. This is from Lisa. This is another message following our episode on Rebecca Lee Crumpler. And Lisa wrote, "Hi, Tracy and Holly, from a very wet and windy Dublin, Ireland. I was thrilled to hear your recent episode on Doctress Rebecca Lee Crumpler, as I used to work as an archivist at the Drexel University Med School Archives in Philadelphia and immediately knew exactly what you're going to say about the medal with the mystery date, since that was my first introduction to her when a researcher asked for a copy of the photo of the medal many years ago. I even more thoroughly enjoyed the behind-the-scenes mini-episode and was practically shouting my answers to your questions about the Black Women Physicians Project, begun by Margaret Gerardo back in the 1980s. I managed to keep the dialogue internal, though, as I didn't think the good people of Sheffield, where I was for the weekend, would appreciate a mud-covered American. I had just finished an especially mucky park run, enthusing loudly about the collection on their buses. So finally, I can share my thoughts here. First, a bit of background on the archives as a whole. They hold the papers of the former Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania and Hahnemann University. It's a bit ironic that the two came together as Drexel University College of Medicine, as the former was one of the first in the United States to admit women, and Hahnemann was one of the very last to do so, although Women's Med started admitting men and became simply the Medical College of Pennsylvania in 1970. Without getting too far off topic, the Hahnemann side of the collection is also a fascinating look at the history of homeopathy, although that focus had been largely dropped by the school by the 1920s, partially because of the earlier Flexner report, which you mentioned. But because of its earlier grounding in that approach, there is a Paracelsus collection of rare books more people should know about, but that's a story for another time. Back to the Black Women's Physician Project, Margaret Gerardo began the work relatively early in her career. She later went on to work at Temple University as an archivist and still consults with the Mother Bethel AME Church Archives. Gerardo created what archivists call an artificial collection, pulling together items from across the Drexel Med archives. And I've spent a goodly amount of time with those boxes. It's often the first place to look when a researcher needs anything relating to Black women in medicine, whether they attended Women's Med or any of its descendant institutions or not. It's essentially an analog, starting to point to other parts of the collection or indeed to others elsewhere. It was an initiative very much ahead of its time and is hugely valuable. Of course, the rest of the collection is also amazing. Other early Black women doctors who did graduate from Women's Med include Rebecca Cole and Eliza Greer. Lisa points to some blog posts and says that they're a little too old now to count as self-promotion. Eliza Greer had a heartbreakingly difficult journey to becoming a doctor and a tragically early death, all too common a story for many early woman doctors. There's a letter in her file from Susan B. Anthony, essentially asking for someone else to offer her some assistance. There's also a great online collection on the question of whether doctor or doctress was the most appropriate title. There were certainly opinions among these early physicians supporting both views. But in short, it's an amazing collection to visit and still the friendliest place I've ever worked. Everyone goes above and beyond to support researchers of all sorts and to make sure that these women's stories are told. If you ever do visit, you can see Harriet, the preserved nervous system of probably Harriet Cole, although with all the caveats we would now have today about informed consent or its historical absence. Apologies for this being so long, but it's a place and team I remember with such fondness, and the care for the collections and drive for accessibility is second to none. I am, of course, also attaching a picture of our two cats, Ruby the Devon Rex, who has made a previous listener mail appearance on a letter from my husband about, of all things, turnips, and Ginger the Tortie. Both are tearing around the house right now. They are the best colleagues anyone could have for working at home. As always, a great listen. Lisa, P.S. I must always make more people aware of Dr. Euthanasia Mead, WMCP class of 1869, later the personal physician of Sarah Winchester of so-called Mystery House fame, and her graduate thesis. It is a triumph of nominative determinism. Please enjoy, Lisa. So thank you so much, Lisa, for all of this. I received this, I think, mere minutes before we read or before we went into the studio to record last Tuesday. I wanted to note a couple of things besides just saying thank you so much for this. One is that there's also a lot in the Boston University School of Medicine history that is about homeopathy. I did not get into any of that in that episode at all because it felt sort of tangential to what we were talking about. But there are a lot of medical schools in the U.S. that like late 19th, early 20th century, were very focused on homeopathy. And I also loved hearing sort of another perspective on this collection, sort of the perspective of someone who has worked there versus the perspective of some students accessing the collection. And of course, two incredibly cute cats sitting on some stairs.
Magical Devon Rex babies. Yeah.
Looking a little startled. Cutie pies. So, thank you so much for this. Lisa, if you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. And we're all over social media at Missed in History. I say all over. It's kind of all over. It's like there's the X that used to be Twitter. There's Facebook. There is Instagram. We put up our new show announcements there. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever else you'd like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.